Keefe himself.
Yeah, Toby Chief Keefe, that's the name. Welcome to the MacGuffin, man. I'm Alex, and with me is James, who just learned some new information about one of his favorite actors. Before we get started, we want to get you to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've done a lot of good content recently. Last week we talked about, or I guess 2 days ago, we talked about drinking buddies.
Woo!
And a little bit about the mumblecore movement, if you will. Before that, we talked about Fargo the movie and Fargo the TV show on the same podcast, and basically two distinct parts in one episode. And before that, 21 and 22 Jump Street. And we've recently talked about Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and all kinds of other things. So yeah, check that out, themacguffinmen.com. Follow us on Twitter at themacguffinmen. No underscores. And our theme song again this week will be replaced by an Ivory Hour song, who are currently on tour across Canada. So check their website, ivoryhours.com, find out if they're playing near you. And yeah, also contribute to their crowdfunding campaign because they're actually good. All right, so here's some Ivory Hours, and then we'll be back to talk AIDS.
Oh, what's happened? I have it all, but I'm not happy. Oh, what's happening to me? I have it all, but I'm not happy.
All right, we're back to talk apes, as promised.
Apes.
Apes.
So
The S is replaced by a 2.
Yeah. Rise of the Planet of the Apes of the Dawn of the Apes?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Don Corleone of the Apes.
Yeah, it's let's see how many tiny words we can fit into this one long title. It reminds me of the Eminem's verses in Renegade, where he says something like, "In which of that is they paint me as," or something. It just turns into a preposition fest.
What other part of this song reminded you of that verse of Renegade?
Well, I mean, it's pretty obvious when Caesar yells "Renegade."
This has already gone wildly off track.
Yeah, well.
Okay, what are we talking about, Alex?
Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Okay, yeah, that's the title.
Yeah, and we are the MacGuffin of the men.
Both of us.
We will both of us, Dawn.
Okay, we're back off track again. Yep. Yes, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Yep.
Sequel
to Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
Which was a fine film.
Yeah, in this one, a sequel with all new humans.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
How'd you like it? So wait, you like the first one, you said? It's fine.
I enjoyed the first one. Yeah, I wasn't as crazy about it as a lot of people were. I think there was a lot of grade inflation in critics' review of that movie, but it's definitely good, and it was a blockbuster about science, which I will always kind of appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it definitely had some good moments. Did you ever see it?
Oh yeah,
yeah. Okay, did you like it?
Oh, I see all James Franco films
yeah.
And slam poetry and whatever else he does.
Huge Palo Alto fan.
Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah.
Maybe I think we talked about it. I think I like it a little bit more than you do, but it's
probably.
I did not think it was a great science fiction film.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you like this one?
I thought it was quite good.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it. Again, I didn't like it as much as I think critics did, but. I thought it was quite legit, James.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to give it the coveted quite legit rating.
Okay, so Alex says this one's a QL.
Yeah, what about you?
I might actually have to drop another QL on this.
Oh, yeah? Did you think it was quite legit?
I did.
Wow.
Yeah, and once again, people are going really nuts for it, which I'm fine with because I'm okay. I'm more than okay with this franchise continuing, and I think it's kind of unique that they're stringing together what seems to be at least a 3 or 4 movie franchise out of an interesting concept. I mean, I know this was a franchise in the 60s, 70s that went on for a while too.
Yeah.
but yeah, I think they're doing some interesting stuff in this, and I'm very curious about.
Hold
curious
on.
To see this one.
Sorry, you cut out. Just what did you say?
I was very curious to see this one, and continue to be curious about where this is going.
Yeah. Yeah, I will say I didn't have many expectations for this movie. I mostly avoided the trailers, as well as one can when they go to the movies as often as I do. But Matt Reeves is a good director, so I had a good feeling about it. And,
yeah, what else would people know Matt Reeves from directing?
Cloverfield is his big movie. He directed that. J.J. Abrams did not direct Cloverfield.
Yes.
If you are one of the 100 people I've told that to over the years. He also directed Let Me In, which I think is a very good movie that nobody fucking saw. It's not as good as what it's remaking, but it's still really good. And he's a very smart, thoughtful director.
Okay. And so what did you like about this?
It was patient. I think similar things that I liked about the first one, but more so in that, there's no real action sequence for at least 40 minutes in this movie. Am I right in saying that? There's like, you know, a moment of suspense when the first ape gets shot early on, but there's no real like big set piece. You know?
I guess you have when when they fight the bear.
Yeah,
that's
I guess.
That's not a massive action sequence or anything, but
yeah,
that's
true.
Kind of your fast-paced bit. I mean, I think where they're coming from with that is that so much of this movie is pretty restrained that I think they want to get some of that in early so people aren't completely bored.
Yeah.
People who care less about kind of some of the scientific themes, which I assume you enjoyed in this movie, and some of the kind of civilization stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, then it is pretty slow for a while, and then we kind of get our any movie where you see a monkey on a horse riding through fire shooting two machine guns simultaneously, it's hard to call completely restrained and thoughtful.
Yeah.
But for the most part that really is a I think an appropriate description of this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just in general throughout the movie the pacing is more patient than what we're kind of used to at this point for movies of this budget. I just thought it was really well made, and the action sequences were good, and there were some cool ideas within them. There were a lot of actual conversations that had weight to them, so that was fun.
So kind of speaking into the lack of action, but maybe less than some people would expect, the posters are Caesar on a horse with a machine gun,
mm-hmm.
with a battle going on behind him. It's taking place on the Golden Gate Bridge and below the Golden Gate Bridge, and it's this really big kind of military fight sequence that does not really exist in the movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of as I said earlier, getting that one action scene with the bear out of the way early, I think they're still trying to sell this as an action franchise and will continue to.
Well, yeah, it is. It just, I think, and it's got very large set pieces. It just has fewer of them, and it takes a while to get to them.
Right. Yeah, I just thought it was interesting to kind of show a battle that doesn't really take place.
Yeah, the poster was the sequel to the movie. That battle will take place in the next film.
Oh, yeah?
No, I'm just making that up. I didn't actually even think about the poster until you mentioned that. But yes, you're correct. That is pretty misleading.
Mm-hmm.
Heaven forbid advertising mislead us, try and trick us into something.
Hollywood, I trusted you.
Yeah. This is like that scene being cut from the Good Burger trailer all over again.
Right.
Yeah.
Deep cuts.
Yeah.
It is interesting that we kind of have an Andy Serkis franchise now, though, like a motion capture franchise. Like, I know Andy Serkis is big and has been an important part of some big franchises, but
he's big to the nerds. You know, he's not like, he's not Brad Pitt, you know?
No, he's nowhere close. And Jason Clarke, who is in this movie, is not really a A-list star. I mean, he certainly seems to be on the rise and gets a lot of critical love, but mm-hmm. the average person, I don't think, still can be able to pick him out of a lineup even after this.
No.
So what do you think of them kind of having this franchise based on someone's face most people wouldn't recognize, someone's face we don't even see in this movie being Andy Serkis, having so much of this movie, I mean, it's equally the screen time is equal between humans and, you know, CGI apes.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I said, Jason Clarke, not exactly A-list at all.
Mm-hmm.
What were you surprised by kind of this casting and how much they're really relying on the CGI? And I know we have, you know, a movie like Avatar can do that.
Yeah.
But are you surprised by kind of the franchise, and will it continue this?
I think it will continue this way. And I think it kind of speaks to the whole idea that the property is always more important than the actual person in it now. You know, like Batman's what draws people to the movie, not Christian Bale or not Chris Evans, but Captain America, you know. And it's kind of been this real change in the last decade that the property is much more important than the person playing the property. And as far as selling the movie, I think the performance is of equal importance, but you don't need a person with the status that you think you probably used to need, right? It's not like we need Will Smith. We need to pay Will Smith $20 million to make sure this movie will open. It's people have figured out how to sell blockbusters in a way that they know they can at the very least buy their first weekend, you know?
Yeah. And I remember reading this, you know, more than probably 10, 15 years ago at this point, but reading articles called The Death of the Movie Star. And it was after, you know, like Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie, Will Smith, a lot of people had, I guess Will Smith would be more recent, but had a lot of these, you know, what were considered untouchable A-list stars had movies that just bombed and just did not make a lot of money. And
yeah, that was around 2010 when that sort of started. Like the movies that you are listing, that's kind of 2010 is around that time.
Yeah, and, you know, we've seen obviously this rise in franchises, you said, and so many of the big hits of the last few years have been, you know, either based on some pre-existing material like a comic book or a movie or something, or you know, a sequel. And it, as you said, you know, it's more about the property. It's more about having the right thing in your title than having the right thing in your cast list. And lately we've seen how you can make a lot of money without that. And this is I mean, people know James Franco, but I judging by how much weird stuff he's done, it's clear that just because James Franco is in something, it's not going to be an A-list blockbuster film or anything like that.
Having his name at the top of your poster is not going to make your movie sell any better.
Yeah, and so it's just really interesting to see this franchise jump, you know, with every movie. And I can imagine it'll be like that the next one. Jason Clarke and everyone from this movie will be dead, maybe make a small cameo somewhere in some I'm a camcorder like James Franco did in this one. But yeah, they really are kind of giving this over to, you know, the title, Planet of the Apes, the franchise, and just being known for having really insanely good CGI and motion capture and Andy Serkis's name. And certainly that's more of a avid filmgoer's piece of knowledge about kind of who Andy Serkis is and what he does, but it's getting bigger and bigger every year, it seems.
Well, yeah, and since the Lord of the Rings movies were such a big deal, a lot of people kind of learned his name then in the early 2000s with Gollum. And it not unlike people kind of knew, is it Ray Park, the Darth Maul guy?
Ray Parker, I think, but yes.
Okay, I think you might be mixing him up with Ray Parker Jr., Ghostbusters song guy.
I probably am, but let's go with Ray Park.
At least we're on the same, you know, the same avenue, at least. Yeah, just sort of the way he became kind of famous despite having a wordless role as Darth Maul, and then he was in X-Men the next year, but, you know, and then kind of just went back to being a stuntman. But yeah, Andy Serkis has kind of found his own place in Hollywood doing, well, I mean, for one, there aren't that many roles for this type of talent. So Andy Serkis isn't busy enough that he can say no to any of these things, right?
Right.
Like, it's kind of just the Lord of the Rings movies. When Gollum comes up, he's got a job. And these Apes movies, he's got a job, you know? And yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, and I read he received a quote healthy seven-figure salary for this role. So I'm sure he's happy with all this.
I can't imagine somebody making seven figures and being like unhappy.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there another franchise? I was trying to think of other franchises that are doing this and really kind of getting away from having a star being the one to tie everything together and just really running with the name. And I guess Transformers has gotten away from Shia LaBeouf and Megan Fox.
Yeah.
And we don't know if, I mean, I don't know at least if there's going to be another one or if Mark Wahlberg will be involved. But is there anything else that is kind of going this way and just running with the title and having the franchise and casting new people, not really relying on that?
More or less every superhero movie. I mean, even if you, I mean, we would say Robert Downey Jr. is a movie star now. He was in movie jail when Iron Man came out, basically, you know, like nobody knew he was a movie star, and that sort of made him a movie star. So, the idea is these people are casting who they feel fit the role, and just counting on the property again, like we just talked about, to make the movie make its money. I think the much more difficult thing to find is something like World War Z, where we actually do have a movie star as the lead of this, at least wannabe franchise, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking of Terminator as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like they seem to be like you could kind of continue to piece things together off your last movie, but they're okay with kind of just jumping around in time and going before or after and
yeah.
casting new, as long as like it seems like they're going.
Sorry.
And as
sorry, what'd you say?
It seems like they're going for the most compelling stories and mm-hmm. then casting who will fit best rather than, okay, can we get Brad Pitt? Let's work backwards from there.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and World War Z, I think, starts because Brad Pitt buys the rights himself, like his pro, I think it's Plan B, his production
yeah.
company. But yeah, no, you are correct. But I think all of the Terminator movies, like Terminator 2 starts, doesn't happen if they can't get Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I think by the time they stop putting Arnold Schwarzenegger in these prime roles, it's just kind of it's Terminator Salvation, which I think came out in 2009, which is where we are starting to get to the point where properties are more important. You know, we're just
right.
starting to get there. And at that time, Christian Bale's never been more famous. You know, he's a year off of The Dark Knight.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Sorry to just try and shit on your point, I guess, but yeah, no, it's just kind of it's definitely a thing that is happening. And you mentioned Avatar. Sam Worthington isn't selling anything else, you know.
Yeah, no, for sure. I've
and Zoe Saldana is also still playing supporting characters in Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah.
Correct. Which we got a trailer for.
Oh, yeah. I saw it at a discount theater, so trailers are kind of a wild card.
Yeah, it was the same trailer that's been going around forever. I don't know what the deal is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Did you think the beginning of this movie was pretty effective? Like, just kind of summing up the last movie and kind of what's been going on the last 10 years on Earth?
Yes. I enjoy when movies do that because it's just kind of a... Here are facts that we are getting across to you, and it's always helpful when you're able to put, you know, a New York mayor and Obama in there as well, and to sort of add some sort of tie into the world that you live in, and then also make us jump forward. I feel like Rise of the Planet of the Apes had something like this in its end credits. I think it was the spreading of the virus, right? I think that happens.
Yeah, very similar to what we see in this one, where we see what look like flight patterns and the planes going everywhere how the disease is spread.
Yeah, because an infected guy goes in an airplane and that's how it starts, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
And then this is kind of the apocalypse.
Yeah.
I mean, the first 2 to 3 minutes is just showing how it spread and then kind of footage and audio of how bad things are. And I think it's easy to bum you out when you have something like the near extinction of the human race to work with, but I thought this was really effective, and I thought that you know, especially when they went down to kind of just audio and it was just the you know, the lights of civilization dimming and the last kind of few flights reaching people, I thought that was really good and just, you know, well done. Got everything into a kind of somber mode, let you kind of know where you are without that first 15 minutes of clunky exposition. Like, it's once mm-hmm. that's kind of done, we get our title card and then the movie's really largely on its way by this point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree.
When we get to meet Jason Clark and Kerry Russell.
Yep. Felicity survived, y'all.
Thanks, Matt Reeves.
Yeah. Well, and you put Cody Smith McPhee in this movie, who said, "Let me in."
Oh, yeah. I knew that. Mm-hmm. What did you think of Kerry Russell and the rest of the crew besides Jason Clark? Well, I guess we didn't really talk about him too much. Did you like him?
Everybody's good. Yeah. I mean, Kerry Russell has nothing to do outside of be maternal and that's basically it.
Carry antibiotics at the right time.
Yeah, exactly. Which is still a just, you know, an upgraded version of maternal behavior. Yeah. And
that's post-apocalyptic maternal behavior.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I thought everybody was good. Most people don't really have a lot to do. I found it extremely frustrating how they brought the guy. I guess this isn't a criticism of acting, never mind. But yeah, no, I thought everybody was good. I was glad to see Jim Gordon back in the movie. That made me pretty happy. He's just straight up playing a slightly more militant version of James Gordon.
But he wears black.
Yeah, no, I got a lot of, even without Gary Oldman, there are a lot of Dark Knight Rises vibes in this movie for me.
Yeah,
in a way that I don't think is negative. I just sort of think you've got these two different groups battling for the core of a city, basically, and one of them is led by Gary Oldman, you know. So there is a lot of that, and but not in a way that hurts the movie by any means. But I thought everybody was good. Gary Oldman's good in everything. That's just sort of the way we've decided Gary Oldman is, and the way he has decided Gary Oldman is.
Just not interviews. He's not.
Yeah, exactly. He's good at everything except not offending people, I guess.
Except being Gary Oldman.
I love how he apologized for his interview about how people shouldn't apologize for interviews. Anyway. But yeah, I thought everybody was good. What about you? Any standouts or?
No. Yeah, I just, no one really had anything to do other than Jason Clark, which.
And even then, he's just supposed to be like the sort of the steady hand, if you will, you know?
Yeah, I just thought I just thought most of the ape characters were more compelling than the human characters. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's great that they can make these characters so expressive and emotive, like the apes, I mean,
yeah,
that you do care about them. But, yeah, I really thought all the human characters were pretty flat. I mean, mm-hmm. to a point where it, I think, detracted from the movie. As you know, Kerry Russell gets nothing to do. Mm-hmm. Hides the gun. It's just a douche.
No, well, I don't think many of the, I don't think there's a lot of fleshing out of anybody but Caesar, basically.
No, there's
I'm
not.
I'm including apes in there as well. Yeah.
I think, yeah, I guess Koba's, well, Koba seems to be Dreyfus with more to do, AKA Gary Oldman.
Yeah.
Kind of more depth.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. I think he has not much more depth than Dreyfus, but maybe more. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think it's pretty clear that those are kind of our like we have Caesar as our, you know, ape version of what's his name in this? Luke?
Sure. I don't know who that is. Oh, the kid?
Malcolm.
Oh, yes, okay.
Jason Clark.
Yeah. You were thinking Skywalker from New Hope.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you know, Dreyfus and Koba are more militant, less trustworthy, you know, second in command.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Did you the other part that kind of got to me, and this is kind of two negative things in a row, and I think I like
it's okay. It's okay.
No, I know. No, I'm just saying I like this movie more than I'm making it sound in the last few minutes, but I did get bored in this movie for sure. Mm-hmm. And it's not because of a lack of fight scenes. Like, I could watch them talk about like how society's still functioning or where they get their fuel and food and stuff like that. Like, I really like this, the kind of post-apocalyptic vibe. I was fine watching the monkeys talk and just reading the subtitles about how all their stuff's going. That's okay. It wasn't like I just needed nonstop action sequences.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt it got really redundant in the middle, and it was, you know, get kicked out, go talk to the leader, get kicked out, go talk to the leader. Like, it just kind of went back to back. so many times with that. And again, it's not that I need Optimus Prime to come and start kicking ass or anything, but it just got really, really redundant for me. And I thought that there was a big area in there where we just kind of explored the same one idea over and over. Mm-hmm. Did you find that at all, kind of in that middle stretch?
I wouldn't say I got bored, but yes, you are correct that definitely happens. It is very much a, like you said, get kicked out, go talk to the leader, and rinse and repeat, basically.
I think it was just at least one too many times for me to stay completely invested in.
Yeah, one too many times where they ask the leader if they should go back to the wall.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, a lot of that's prompted by this sort of comedy of errors and misunderstandings of Kobo seeing Dreyfus testing the guns. And
you
that.
Did it. You called him Kobo. I was wondering which one of us was going to call it Kobo first.
I did. It says it in my notes.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Kobo, you know, Carver still having the gun and stuff like that. Like, and I understand that this is kind of sowing the seeds of the. I think they just leaned on kind of the same two points really hard in that middle stretch. And the thing that a lot of critics seem to like about this is that, you know, they're playing with some of these interesting ideas, and that we, you know, we're fine with giving a lot of screen times to the apes, you know, pretty much 50-50, and that's still being exciting. And that's certainly not something I disagree with. I just don't think that I don't think that's a completely accurate assessment of how this movie stayed interesting throughout, because I don't think it did.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. I don't disagree. And I think the really interesting ideas come very late in this film, I find. And yeah, I can definitely see how you feel like it. Certainly peters out a bit at one point. The part that I referred to a bit earlier, and you brought it up, that made me so fucking furious, was when they brought... Did you say his name was Carver, the guy that shoots the ape at the beginning?
Yeah.
When they bring him on their recon mission with them after that? Like, what the hell thought process is that? I was baffled. Baffled at that decision.
Forgiveness. You know?
Forgive. Oh, great. Yeah. I was so, so mad. I was, that was such a dumb screenwriting decision to let that character still be okay with Carver. That I was very on the fence about the movie at that point. Yeah, I was so offended by the dumbness of that character.
Yeah,
at that point.
Yeah. Foster's only role is to remove Carver that time, and then, I guess, does not keep him away successfully. Yeah. Like, I don't know what that's about either. I understand not just shooting him in the chest, but I think you leave him back in the city.
Leave him
in
San Francisco.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. What did you think about the big kind of fight scene? It's in San Francisco when they're attacking the tower.
Well, there's kind of the two big sequences, right? There's the middle one where the apes kind of, I mean, they visited San Francisco already, but they like really, like you said, ride on horseback and shoot two machine guns at Gary Oldman, through fire, no less. I thought that sequence was really great. And just in a way that was just sort of well directed. There was that shot of what I'm going to call the tank shot, where the camera was strapped to the tank, and we saw one of the apes killing the guy that was operating the gun, going into the tank, killing the other person that was in the tank, and then taking control of the gun, all while the head of the tank is spinning around. And I thought that was a really, really cool, interesting way to give us sort of this really, I mean, the 360-degree look at what was happening, but also in a way that was so engaging and so interesting. And I think that's also the same sequence where Malcolm goes to get the medical supplies so that Felicity can operate on Caesar. And that
Caesar's wife.
Caesar. No, because this is when they've got to take the bullet out of Caesar.
When he's shot. Right.
Yeah. And it's, you know, kind of a long take in the middle of an action sequence that is really interesting, where he's like running down the hallway and stuff, and he ends up getting spotted by an ape at the very end that walks away from him. But that was just a really good take. And the kind of like mid-length to short long take that I like a lot, and I thought that was really good. You know, I thought that whole sequence was very good. I liked it more than the climactic battle, if you will, for sure.
Yeah, I really like that one shot you mentioned with the tank because
it's bonky. That's why you
love it. Well, right, because of that. Anyway, moving. No, no, it's sometimes with I mean, and this is something that's I'm sure largely taken care of, as we've seen in movies like Gravity and some of the Lord of the Rings stuff. But when I know there's a lot of CGI and green screen, I kind of watch out for things being played out in two dimensions, like having your actors and then having your green screen in the back, and then that's kind of it, like a stage almost. Mm-hmm. And I know that this movie is not entirely CGI, like parts of Avatar or Gravity definitely would be. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it gives you that 360 degree view, as you said, and they have the camera kind of just attached to the tank, and it's careening out of control. Like, it's just, once the guy gets killed, I guess he slumps on the controls, or the controls go out. So it's going forward, but it's also just kind of slowly drifting left as it moves, like as the turret's turning, as the tracks are going forward, I guess. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that kind of spinning view where you get to see the whole battlefield and you get a really good hold of the geography and everything, and you get that really immersive, big, three-dimensional scenario that you're put inside of. I thought that was you know, one of the best parts, and it just shows the scale of the city and the scale of the battle and everything, and the way that these apes you know, they've definitely come along in their intelligence and their use of technology. Like, they, I didn't see it, but it seems they figured out how to reload at some point.
Yeah,
because they never carry ammo around, but yeah, whatever. Yeah, I liked how we kind of see, in that shot for me, was they're starting to get it. Like, they can stop someone in a tank, they can use some guns and some turrets and things like that, but they're not that complete human intelligence, at least in this respect, yet. They still have this thing careening out of control, and you get this a view from there that really shows kind of thematically where they are in their development. And as I said, just gives you this really grand scale of what's going on in the geography of the movie too. And I think that just did so much in one shot that also happened to just look really cool and be at a really tense moment, that I thought that was like kind of the standout visual for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, it's a tank careening out of control, but the camera is very strongly fastened to the thing that is careening out of control. And right, just that contrast adds an extra element to the shot that's really cool, that like having a cameraman sitting on that tank and just going handheld wouldn't have, you know?
Yeah, no, it does. It's different than just having the chaos of someone with, you know, shaky cam or steady cam or however you want to call it, whether you like it or not. It still gives you that sense of chaos and that sense of things being completely out of control, but does it in a different way, and one that I can't think of it off the top of my head if I have seen it. So, you know, it's new to me.
It was new to me. The one other shot that's kind of like that they kind of chickened out on midway through, kind of bummed me out, was when the bus is being turned over, and we've got that camera fixed in the bus on the inside, and we get cuts out to the apes flipping the bus over. It's the one with that giant ape in it. I forget his name.
Maurice,
yeah. The people that, you know, side with Caesar, that Koba then locks up to keep them away.
Yeah.
They get their bus flipped, and the camera inside that's fastened to the bus is a really cool shot that they cut away from a couple times. It bums me out. But Matt Reeves had done that before in Let Me In. There's a really great shot of that they do not cut away from. It's a car flipping, and the camera flips with the car, and it's really fucking cool. And it's just kind of, it's the same thing about the tank shot that we love so much. It's just, it's chaos shown from a very fixed, unchaotic position. And it's really cool.
Yeah, no, I know exactly the shot, and I appreciated that too. And now I want to see Let Me In a little bit more.
Yeah, I think it's good. And, you know, it's got Richard Jenkins. Who doesn't love him?
Right. Mm-hmm. Speaking of A-list stars.
Yeah, he's the A-B-list, though. He's the A-list of character actors.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Your boy Kevin Rankin's in this movie.
Yeah, sure. That's what I'm told.
No, the guy from Breaking Bad that him and his buddy are apparently just shooting at SUVs for no reason all day.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Um,
I thought those scenes would absolutely piss you off with Goofy Monkey and Goofy music.
Well, the thing that did it have Goofy music?
At that those parts it did. When the apes were pretending to be stupid circus apes or whatever those scenes were about.
Yeah, yeah.
That was weird. I didn't like the music in this movie.
And no, I agree.
Yeah, there's a couple really weird. It's definitely in this one scene I'm talking about, but there are these weird like harp punches that just sound really out of place and don't work at all for me. Like that was one. And I'm usually someone who does not like it, I think the music's fantastic or I don't really notice it sometimes. This one like stood out as problematic for me.
There's a lot of moments in this movie where it sounds like you just got a text message. You know, like there's a lot of like weird sounds that don't fit. And you're like, is the person's next to me phone on? Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I meant with one of those harp sounds. It's just kind of an ascending string. And the first time they use it is kind of a tense moment. It was really jarring in a bad way. And then they kind of build on that theme and you hear that sound a few more times. And then it's kind of a bigger sound all around it. It sounds a little bit better, but to go just with that, yeah, it sounds like a fucking ringtone. And really, I really didn't like it. Really kind of took me out of some very important moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking of important moments, let's jump to maybe the most important moment of the film.
James Franco?
Yes, of course. it is actually right around there where we get Caesar realizing that just because Koba is an ape doesn't mean he's better than some of the humans, specifically Malcolm. And that's kind of the most interesting thing about this movie to me is that the real difference isn't really between species as much as it is between the ideologies. And these things can be held within each group. But yeah, I thought that was really cool. And that Caesar realizes he's more like Malcolm than he is like Koba. And I feel like that's the real turning point for the thought process of this movie. And I really enjoyed that a lot. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. We have the scene where Caesar and Koba fight, mm-hmm. Koba's kind of taken the alpha status through a false flag operation. I'm waiting for the, American Empire conspiracy theory reading of this movie.
Oh, man.
Between the tower collapse, 9/11 style, and the Koba burning down the Monkey City.
So the guy in the back of my theater just yelling Illuminati over and over again. I think that's the reading.
Yeah. I almost tried to put one together. Realize that was even a bigger waste of time than doing this podcast is in the first place. Yeah.
Well, if you write the capital, the title in all caps, there are a lot of A's in the title, and so there are a lot of triangles. The presidency is a lie, is basically what I'm saying.
Yeah. Clearly. And the V in Matt Reeves.
Oh my God.
He's got a V and an A.
Oh.
Koba and Caesar do their battle and Caesar prevails and really kind of just monkey thrashes on Koba for a while.
Yeah, okay, so we're talking about the first
time. Yeah, and renders him pretty bloody and just allows him to live and does their little monkey hand tap forgiveness touch.
Monkey daps is what it's called.
Monkey daps. Yeah. Rise of the Planet of the Daps. Yeah, and that kind of that point, we still have this very species-oriented way of looking at the world. And even though Caesar and Malcolm are still willing to let the other one live and believe there's a chance that they live in harmony, it seems like everyone's closer with everyone from their species. And then as time passes, we see Malcolm's kid and Maurice reading a book together adorably. And yeah, most importantly, as you said, is Caesar realizing that Koba is bad. And even though one of their first rules of ape civilization was apes don't kill other apes.
Yeah.
We get this understanding that once you reach a certain level of intelligence in creatures, there's going to be good and bad. Mm-hmm. And that's something Malcolm even kind of struggles with. Like, he kind of sees apes as the better species. Like, they're kind of more pure and get along better and don't rely on all this external technology and seem to have a very peaceful existence. But then he kind of sees Koba and, gets to know Caesar a little more and sees that there is definitely a spectrum between good apes and bad apes, just as there are with humans. And it's really Caesar that has to struggle with it the most when he lets Koba fall to his death. And yeah, that's just something that, you know, that's where we get this kind of coming together of the species, even though it's in such a negative context that, you know, we see now and they see now that apes can be just as evil as humans. That allows the good humans to the good humans and the good apes to come together and kind of fight mutual enemies and, mm-hmm. you know, whatever species they are. And in the big, you know, the finale of this movie is those two getting along and saying, oh, there's clearly going to be all this, you know, human military reinforcement coming. We can't communicate this understanding that you and I have developed to all humans ever. And, you know, you just have to run away. Like, yeah. It seems like those two have it figured out, but there's no, you know, he says humans aren't going to forgive or whatever. And, you know, we're just at this point where those two have kind of discovered that this can work out. But given the situation and all this misunderstanding and all the death that has happened, that still seems to be ongoing, that there's just no chance. And that's kind of it for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just kind of because I was surprised when Caesar drops Koba.
I was too.
Yeah. And I thought it was like a really dark turn for the movie to take. And I mean, what Caesar decides is kind of just a different version of the decision Dreyfus makes, or I suppose a slightly less aggressive version of the decision Dreyfus makes just before when he decides to kill himself and probably at least two other people, two other humans, to get some more apes dead, basically. And
like the Dark Knight.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting that Dreyfus and Caesar end up making similar decisions and being stuck in similar situations, that deciding that the death of one is in the long run helpful. And I thought that was really interesting. You know, Dreyfus believes that him killing these apes is helping save the human race. I think he did less than he had hoped with that, you know. But I think I don't know, that Caesar killing Koba is just, I don't know, like, I feel like that changes everybody's opinion of him, you know, like all the apes' opinion of him. And I just thought that in a way that I thought was kind of odd. And I think if Dreyfus doesn't blow up this tower, I was wondering, does Caesar do the same thing? Like, I know the fall half exists because of what Dreyfus does, but like, without the idea of Dreyfus having blown this tower, do you think Caesar still does the same thing?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's an important distinction to be made between their two decisions, though. I think they're in kind of a similar decision, but Dreyfus accepts human sacrifice for the good of humans. Like, he's willing to kill himself and, you know, in order to kill a bunch of apes, whereas Caesar is just killing one ape,
yeah.
Just kind of to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It is similar, though, because they are sacrificing of their own species, but Caesar seems to be, I don't know the word, but yeah, I guess just more aggressive. Like, it's just one-on-one and you know, he's not sacrificing himself. I think he's kind of sacrificing a little bit of the,
he's directly, like, he's looking into somebody's eyes and watching them die,
you know? Yeah, yeah, no, for sure.
I will let this happen.
Yeah, I was gonna say, if that was a human doing it, I would say he sacrifices a bit of his humanity, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. He kind of accepts something about his entire species by killing Koba. Like, mm-hmm. It's we're not all good, I can't rehabilitate you to be good. And I think the thing we haven't mentioned yet is Koba is so upset at humans because of his experience with them was essentially torture. Mm-hmm. Like he was a lab animal, whereas Caesar was, you know, a bit of a lab animal, but like a house lab animal, and was learning things and being treated very, very well.
Yeah, he was hanging out with James Franco and John Lithgow. You know?
How does it get better than that?
Yeah. He was the new Harry. Yeah,
yeah, but just the fact that Caesar has kind of what is the big emotional moment of this movie, I think, speaks to how well they have made characters out of the apes and not just as something we haven't seen fight at this in this way before. Like, really makes interesting characters with you know, moral struggles in them, and mm-hmm. that's kind of the best I could have hoped for this movie, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, just sort of the admission that I think Caesar at the very end of this movie says to Malcolm, just says the war has already started, you know, and that's sort of like just accepting that we've already come too far and there's no way back. Like, by the time a war starts, you've already lost is kind of the end point of this movie. And there's a lot of, I mean, we talked about the Koba Dreyfus versus Caesar and Malcolm differences. It's a lot of pro science and medicine on Caesar and just being thoughtful on Caesar and Malcolm's side, and a lot of pro violence on the other side. And this movie is very anti-gun, I think, very anti-violence. But the main point is that basically once a gun has been fired, it's over, you know? And the idea is to stop the climax of this movie should be stopping the climax of this movie, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I guess in Killing Koba, we have an attempt to reduce future violence. I mean, he would have been such a incendiary leader. I mean, we see it well. He is alpha male, that things get so violent so quickly. Mm-hmm. I guess we have Caesar doing what he feels is a rightful killing to reduce further killing, which is always a slippery slope. But I have to say, I agree.
But I think it's the question there is all about how does it change the people, the large number of people watching this, how does it change their opinion of you? You know, are they less likely to trust Caesar now? Yeah.
Right. And
now they've seen him straight up drop a dude to his death.
Exactly. And earlier in the movie, we see Koba kill Ash just to consolidate power, pretty much. Just to say, look, if you disagree with me, I'm going to kill you. Is that so much different than what Caesar does? We have that idea, though, of that spectrum of good and bad. And we've seen Caesar take the nonviolent route, mm-hmm. even when, you know, Carver shoots an ape very early on, they could go nuts on this whole, on all the humans that are there and kill them all. Mm-hmm. He just sends them away. So we do see him take chances to reduce the violence. And, you know, as you said, the war, that line about the war already having started is an important one. And yeah, this movie is, again, just pro thoughtfulness, pro understanding, pro communication. Mm-hmm. We eliminate the most dangerous people on the spectrum and in an attempt for things to be safer. Mm-hmm. And kind of the best side of the spectrum, the best people are, or the best characters we have are Malcolm and Caesar, who have managed to forge this communication and this trust and this understanding, but all the other people lower on the spectrum are not privy to all the knowledge that they are already just, you know, having this huge, huge war outside. And that's, at that point, it's just beyond the tipping point.
Yeah, for sure.
Is the CGI as good as everyone says?
I'm going to say no.
No?
Yeah.
You mean distractingly bad moments or just nothing that blew you away?
Or? I think... For the most, I mean, I just saw Snowpiercer, which, if we're talking distractingly bad CGI, it's a party of distractingly bad CGI. But, you know, I've tried to, over the years, just sort of stop caring about that and just sort of try and focus on the story. But, you know, it jumps out at you. And I don't think the CGI in this movie is as good as people have been talking about. It doesn't hurt the movie for me because, again, I just try and focus on the ideas more than more than, you know, the graphic design, I suppose. But and that's not to talk down about the job, but yeah, no, it doesn't hurt the movie for me. But I do not think that the CGI is as good as people talk about it. I think it's mostly that the motion capture thing and how impressive people think that is, you know?
That's why people are talking about it so much.
Which is quite impressive, you know? Because the, I don't know, there is a real feeling of, particularly Caesar, feeling like a character, which is impressive given the fact that there are a lot of techniques that we've, that are the easiest way to get across things about this character, specifically by speaking a lot, that Caesar just doesn't do. And I think it's very interesting that we can get Caesar as we've seen him. You know, it's very interesting. And there's a lot of really great close-ups, I think. You know, all the close-ups are really impressive. But it's sort of in the wider shot where things get a little shaky.
Okay. Yeah, and it's not just, you know, having him, you know, single tier or whatever, but you just do see expressions and kind of nuances to a performance that I just didn't know we'd get in CGI and motion capture like that.
Yeah, exactly. I had a similar version of the same thing with I thought Zoe Saldana was really good in Avatar, you know.
Right. Yeah, you did love her in that.
'Cause she's really great in it.
Okay.
Also, there's so much bad shit in that movie. The good thing really shines, you know.
Something to hold on to. Yeah. Anything else about this movie, or do you want to talk about the future of this franchise and the sequel that's already been announced?
I don't know. I guess I just don't. I don't have any thoughts. You know. Well, I know there will be a sequel. I will see that sequel. But yeah, I don't know what to expect, which is probably good.
Yeah, that is good, right? Like, yeah. With the 10-year jump between this one and the last one. And I assume a similar size jump in the next one.
I don't know that I can assume that. I think there's a much better chance that the next one is a more direct sequel to this.
Okay.
Yeah. I really wouldn't be surprised if Malcolm is a part of the next movie.
It seems like there's so like the kind of intro where we have the world really falling to shit would have made for a good movie as well, but they passed up that opportunity to kind of get more to the ape centric stuff. Is that just because they wanted to get ape centric so quickly?
Probably. They wanted to sort of keep a half and half thing, and you make the human dynamic more interesting than just being like, death is coming, I'm terrified, you know?
Yeah.
So I think having these two different already established camps, makes it more interesting than watching them get established, you know?
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, no, like I said, I mean, I'm generally not good at predicting where sequels go. So, you know, if Malcolm's not in the next movie, don't be surprised. But yeah. I think just because of how big the movie is, they might think that they should, like how big of a hit it has been, they might think that they should keep more threads, you know?
Yeah. And if Jason Clark keeps killing it, then.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that?
No, I mean he's kind of been kicking around as a Sam Worthington type for a bit, you know. Yeah. If he was gonna become a superstar, it would have happened by now.
Is Koba dead?
I hope so. I don't want to see like Shredder rising up out of the garbage pile in Ninja Turtles 2 with him. I hope so.
Okay, because he does kind of hit that stuff on the way down as he falls down that tunnel.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A reason I still don't understand.
Yeah.
Other than the possibility of saying he survived. Mm-hmm. And I didn't stick around for this, but while reading about the movie after, there is, after the credits, the sound of like rubble being moved and an ape breathing heavily. And I think it's Koba.
Woof.
Yeah, I didn't think you liked that news. I didn't even share it with you.
Yeah.
So I am kind of, I was very interested to see if they could keep skipping kind of 10 years and doing new people and new situations. But I think this next one's going to be a much more direct sequel the way that you think it is. And I think Koba and Caesar and Malcolm are all going to be there. I think we might have a few years down the road, maybe. Like, I don't know if this movie starts, you know, tomorrow of this world.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we have that. And I think we're set up for a pretty dominant, like we have a lot of these apes who people know and have established that, you know, they can have kind of half of this movie and talk and still be very emotionally effective. And I think they've laid a good foundation for the next one again.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. I mean, I can't say I'm really looking forward to it. I don't know, but I will definitely see it when it exists, you know?
And then we'll podcast about it.
Probably, unless we hate each other by then.
2 more years?
I think we can make it 2 more years. Okay. If it was coming out in 2017, we might be in trouble.
to two more years.
2 more years of our friendship. Thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check back next week. And in the meantime, check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, for our older content. And also...
Everyhours.net.
.com. This isn't 1996. Nobody has their goddamn website with .net. Yeah, check them out as well. Anyways, thanks for listening. The same as I left you, my fickle heart.